So just to give you an overview of what we'll be covering this week, today I'm going to start with a very brief introduction into quantum optics. I'll talk about Wigner functions and also give you a bit of an introduction to nonlinear optics, which you're going to need to know to understand spontaneous parametric downconversion, which is a process that we use to generate non-classical states of light. So I'll try and cover all of that today. Then in the tutorial, we're going to look at Hong-O-Mandel interference, which you've seen a couple of times in the tutorial, in some other lectures, but only in a very cartoon sense. And here we're going to do a full multimode analysis where we're going to look at the spectral distribution of the photons coming in and look at the time delays and see how that behaves. Then in tomorrow's lecture, we're going to also do a detailed multimode analysis of spontaneous parametric downconversion, and we're going to look at the pairs of photons that are created and their spectral correlations and how that affects the purity of each of the individual photons. If you want to do a little bit of reading up on that beforehand, you can check out this paper by Warren Grice and Ian Walmsley. It's a pretty simple paper to read. Then on Wednesday, we're going to have the discussion, which is open at the moment. We can, I guess I'll be going through all of this pretty quickly, so there'll definitely be outstanding questions, so we can talk about all of those on the discussion on Wednesday. Then on Thursday, I'll tell you about a slightly different model of linear optical quantum computation, which relies on encoding the qubits into the states of into coherent states with opposite phase. And so this is kind of interesting because these are not orthogonal states, but still you can use them for computation. If you want to read up on that, you can check out this paper by Tim Ralph and other authors. And then on Friday, I will talk about another model of quantum computation called cluster state quantum computation, which is a really cool model that's completely equivalent to the circuit model that you've already seen. But it's also different in some fundamental ways. So there, what you do is you create this really huge entangled initial state. And so that's the hard bit. But then once you've entangled that, after you've created that, your entire computation is just single qubit measurements on the qubits and the cluster state, and then classical feed forward. So it really takes the difficulty of the computation and puts it into the state preparation, and then makes the computation simple. So that was introduced by Rausendorf and Bregel in 2001. But the lecture I'm going to give is going to be based on a really nice tutorial by Michael Nielsen, which you can also see on the archive. And then on Friday, we're going to look at GHZ states. And this is going to kind of be a speculative, open-ended tutorial. So I was at this workshop on Thursday and Friday, which was all about what do we need to do to build an optical quantum computer. And there was lots of experimentalists and lots of theorists. And one particular researcher from Imperial College, Terry Rudolph, I guess I'm going to paraphrase him, but he pretty much said that building an optical quantum computer is essentially as hard as coming up with a source of GHZ states. So if we can have a nice, reliable source of optical GHZ states, then you can just go, you know, and build your quantum computer. So we're going to see if we can come up with some ways of generating GHZ states. Okay. I don't expect that we're going to succeed, but it'll be nice to explore the challenges involved in that. Okay, so by now you're all probably familiar with the standard model of quantum computation that we start off with a set of initial states, and then we perform gates on those states, and then we measure the output qubits, and that gives us the readout of the computation. And you've learned that there are many different physical architectures that we can use to try and build our quantum computer. And so for this week, like I've mentioned, I'm going to be discussing mostly optical implementations. And in Ray's lecture, you saw how you can implement the gates on the optical states. So we saw that single qubit gates are pretty easy. They're just done with passive linear optics. And the entangling gates are actually really tricky because light doesn't like interacting with light. But there are techniques for doing that probabilistically, like the KLM scheme. So we've seen already a little bit about how to perform the gates. So for these lectures, I'm going to focus more on how to prepare the states of light. So this is important, of course, because we need to, you know, have some sort of state of light to encode the information before we start processing the information. But it's also important because non-classical states of light can serve as a resource for performing different types of gates. So if you want to do a teleportation gate, for example, you need a resource state, entangled state, to do that teleportation. And then also, non-classical states of light can be resources for doing interesting measurements, like weak measurements, for example, or other POVMs. So that's the motivation for why we're going to talk about sources. So let's start with the most fundamental state of light that we can think of, and that is the single photon. So you saw in Ray's lectures that we were always encoding our information into the single photon, either in the path degree of freedom or in the polarization degree of freedom. But how do we actually make these single photons? So there's like photons everywhere, right? So it should be pretty easy. But they're not really nice, clean sources of photons. So what could we do? Well, we could take a laser, for example. Lasers seem like they're pretty nice, clean sources of light. So could we just take a laser, which is essentially like a photon gun, right? And then just turn down the intensity until it's so low that a single photon just comes out every now and then, and then we can use it. But it turns out that this doesn't work because the state of a laser is a state of uncertain photon number. So it has this photon number distribution. So if I plot the photon number distribution of a laser source, I'll see that it has this particular Poissonian distribution. Where the average photon number is going to be the center of this distribution. So if I just have a really weak source, then what I find is that this distribution just shifts to the left, and I get something that looks like this. So this is 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. And so it's always going to behave classically. Well, I don't want to say classically, but it's not going to give us the non-classical behavior we want from a single photon. And so what this means is that with even for a low intensity laser, I'm going with some probability I'll have no photons being created. With some probability I'll have one photon being created or two photons and so on. So that's no good. So it's going to take us a while to build up to this spontaneous parametric downconversion source. So just to, you know, not to keep you in suspense, I'll tell you quickly how it's done. You take this, you take a nonlinear crystal, and then you shine a pump laser on this crystal, so nonlinear. And then with some probability, one of those photons from this pump laser gets split up into a pair of photons. But this is a spontaneous process, and you don't really know when it happens. But what you can do is put a photon number resolving detector on this mode. And when that detector says click, I have a single photon, then you know that you have a single photon in this mode, because they always come out correlated in pairs. So that's, and then you can go and use the single photon in your computation. But this is a very cartoony picture, and in order to understand more thoroughly what's going on here, we're going to need to first learn a little bit of quantum optics and a little bit of nonlinear optics. So that's kind of where we're heading. But for now, let's come back to the laser. So if we have a single mode laser, for example, a continuous wave laser that's a particular, specific color, we can actually write down the quantum state of a laser. And we like to write things down in what's called the Fock basis, or the photon number basis. So you can see it's this coherent superposition of different number states. But the entire thing is parameterized by this complex number alpha, where the magnitude of alpha is going to tell you what the intensity of the laser is. And the phase of alpha will tell you what the phase of the laser is. So the mean photon number is going to be given by mod alpha squared. And then the argument of alpha is the phase. Okay. And if we want to calculate what this probability distribution here is, we can just use the standard rule for calculating probability distributions, which is Born's rule. So we can define a projector onto a photon number state, and then we can just calculate the probability. So it's going to be trace rho times the projector. Which is trace of alpha n. And because alpha is a pure state, we can simplify it like this. And you can do this calculation, it's pretty easy. But if you project the n state onto here and then take the absolute value squared, you get something that looks like a Poisson distribution. And this is a Poisson distribution with where the mean is mod alpha squared. So this is exactly what I was plotting here. Yes, it should. Thank you. Oops. Okay, so I've just like used these states ket n, but I haven't really told you what they are. So I'm going to spend the next part of the lecture motivating where these Fock states come from. Okay. So what are these states? And Well, they are the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian of the electromagnetic field. So I'm not going to go through the entire derivation of how we quantize the electromagnetic field because that would take an entire lecture. And you can find this in any standard quantum optics book. But I will just give you the recipe for how this would be done. So as I've said, these are the eigenstates of the EM Hamiltonian. Okay. And here is the recipe for quantizing them. The EM field. Oops. Okay, so the first step, of course, is going to be start with Maxwell's equations because they tell us how light behaves. And then it's typical to choose the Coulomb gauge. Where this is the vector potential. Then, with that, we can. So, we have a set of equations. We've chosen this condition. So, now what we can do is solve these equations for the vector potential. So, we can solve this to get a wave equation. Oh, sorry. First, we rewrite everything to get the wave equation for the vector potential. And then once we have a wave equation, we can solve it. And typically, we take a volume, a cube of volume V, to give us the boundary conditions for how to solve that equation. And so then, once we have an expression for the vector potential, we can use that to determine the expressions for the electric field and the magnetic field. And just to give you an example, the one for the electric field looks like this. And so at this point in time, these AKs are just complex numbers. And these functions UK are a set of orthogonal basis functions, which it's very convenient to take these to be just the plane wave functions. And we see that it's a sum over these terms, but and so it's typically pretty easy to work with a discrete sum, but then at the end, people take the volume to infinity and the sum goes to an integral. Okay, so we have the classical solutions, and then quantizing the field, which is a very mysterious thing, is just to promote this complex number to a operator that satisfies some commutation relations. So now we choose AK and a dagger k to be mutually adjoint operators. And so they satisfy the following commutation relations. Okay, and so when we do that, this complex conjugate goes to a Hermitian conjugate. And so here we've quantized the electromagnetic field. So now what we can do is write down the classical Hamiltonian for the electromagnetic field. I don't have this written down, so, but I presume this is an integral over the volume. Can anyone correct me if I'm wrong on that? Anyway, let's go with that. Let's say it's an integral over the volume. And so now it's a matter of substituting these expressions for the electric field and also the similar expression for the magnetic field. And then we get something that looks like a collection of harmonic oscillators. And sometimes we call this operator, this A dagger A operator, as the number operator for the mode K. Okay, so here we see that we can now think of the electromagnetic field as just a collection of uncoupled harmonic oscillators, which makes things much easier. Okay, so now we can say, I'll write it up here. So now we have a Hamiltonian, and it turns out that these Fock states are the eigenstates. Of H. So this means that if we act H on n, we get out the eigenvalue h bar omega k n k plus a half. So this is now going to be the energy of this state. And here you can see that it depends on the photon number. And also these states n k are going to be the eigenstates of the number operator. So if we act the number operator for mode k, we get out the number of photons in that mode. And it's also going to be useful just to know how these creation, how these operators A and A dagger k act on the on these eigenstates. So you can see that if I act this operator A on a state nk, I'm going to reduce the number of photons by one. And if I act the state, the operator A dagger on nk, I'm going to increase it by one. So these operators are typically referred to as creation and annihilation operators because they create a photon or annihilate a photon. And so you may be noticing that this is completely identical to what we see when we have a non-relativistic particle in 1D in a harmonic potential. So this is just a side note. Completely analogous. So the free energy of a non-relativistic particle is p squared on 2m. And then if we have a harmonic potential, we can write it like this. And typically, what people do is they rewrite x. Well, they define x in terms of raising and lowering operators. And also p in terms of these raising and lowering operators. And if you do that, then the Hamiltonian that you get is h bar omega a dagger a. So pretty much like quantum optics is just doing the 1D harmonic oscillator problem. So you already know how to do quantum optics, which is great. Of course, this is just for a single mode, and here we're dealing with a sum of all of the modes, so it makes things more complicated. But at least intuitively, you should have an idea of what's going on. Okay, so in the case of the particle in the harmonic potential, it was useful to rewrite the position and momentum in terms of these creation and annihilation operators. So here, it's also useful to kind of go the other way, to rewrite our creation and annihilation operators in terms of these operators that kind of look like position and momentum in that case, but they're not really position and momentum. They're what are known as quadratures, and they represent the real and imaginary part of the field. So similarly, in quantum optics, it's useful to define. So I'm going to call this Q. It's going to be 1 on root 2 A dagger plus A. And P will be I on root 2 A dagger minus A. And the reason we like to do that is because it allows us to define what's known as a Wigner function, which is a quasi-probability distribution on these operators, P and Q. I should probably write this down. So before I tell you more about this Wigner function, I want to give you a handout. So I went ahead and plotted the Wigner functions for a bunch of states, some of which we've already seen, the Fock state and the coherent state, but also there are some other states that we're going to encounter through the rest of the week. So just take one and pass it along. For anyone that's watching online and is sad that you don't get to see the handout, what you can do is Google adventures in phase space, and then you'll get a YouTube video. And so it's a video that I made when I was procrastinating doing my PhD thesis, and it's got a whole bunch of Wigner functions that move around. Okay, so why do we even like want this to define another function? You know, we already have so many things to deal with. Why? Why do we need another function? Well, so one reason is that so there's a direct mapping between the density matrix and the Wigner function, and you know how to calculate the dynamics of states in the density matrix picture, but there's an analogous way to calculate the dynamics of the Wigner functions. And in some situations, it may actually be easier to do it that way than doing it with the density matrix. So it gives us another way to compute the dynamics. It also helps to build intuition. So I know at the beginning of the course, there was like some resistance, at the beginning of the year, there was some resistance to learn the Bloch sphere because it just seemed, you know, like, oh, this is just the same thing as, you know, writing down the density matrix. But I hope after working with it and playing around with, you know, dephasing noise and all that, you were convinced that it's actually really useful to have this visual representation, which helps guide intuition. And so this is going to be the case also with the Wigner function. It also helps communication between physicists. And so that's the same as with the Bloch sphere. Like, you know, if we're just having a chat on the board or I'm going to be giving this lecture, I can just, you know, scribble down some Wigner function and you know what I mean. I don't have to write down complicated equations. So it gives us this visual tool for communicating. Another thing is that I don't think this is actually negative. I don't think this is well defined, but there is definitely this notion of that if the Wigner function goes negative, then that's a sign of non-classicality. So if we have states that are classical, they're typically states that have positive Wigner functions. But things like the Fock states, if you look at it, you'll see that it dips below zero. So the negativity of the Wigner function is a sign of non-classicality. And the last reason why you'd want to do it, play around with the Wigner function, is because it's beautiful. I'm sure you can see they're really pretty functions. And I love putting them in my papers because they look really nice. Okay. So. Pardon me?
The non-classicality, is it like something that is fundamentally proven?
No, I don't think so. No. That you're saying that. Yeah.
You can't violate them.
I mean, so it seems the fact that it's a quasi. I mean, if you want to make a connection between probability distributions, you know they can't go negative. And so if it goes negative, then it does give you some. It gives you some indication that you're dealing with non-commuting observables and that you can't measure at the same time. I know, so, but are you saying that it's been proven that if it goes negative, then I have a non-classical state? But if it's not negative, then that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a non-classical state.
Yes.
Yeah. Sorry, that it's a classical state. Yeah. Yeah, maybe you're right. I I mean, it kind of, it would, I think define, making statements about what's classical and what's non-classical are really iffy as well. Yeah. But I mean, I could be totally wrong. It could be much more rigorous than I'm claiming it to be. Okay, so. Actually, so with this helps to build intuition at point, I'm in the cat state lecture, I'm going to get you guys to try and use your intuition to figure out how we might be able to build these, what are they called? Macroscopic superpositions called cat states. But at least, so there's no general scheme for making them for large alpha, but there are schemes for making good approximations for small alpha. And using the handout that I've given you, you might be able to guess what the current scheme is for generating cat states with small alpha. So don't do that now, but keep that in mind for later. Okay, so what actually, how do we write down the Wigner function? Well, we can define it as the Fourier transform of what's known as a characteristic function. So the characteristic function is a function of a complex value eta, and it depends on the density matrix, which is what we would want. So you start off with your density matrix, you multiply it by this exponential operator and take the trace. And then we take this weird Fourier transform. And so now we integrate over the parameter eta that we defined here, and then we're just left with something that's a function of beta, which is another complex number that depends on LQ and LP, which are our quadratures. And just a couple of properties. So the Wigner function can be negative. And it's normalized. So if we integrate over P and Q, we get something that's one. So that's similar to a probability distribution. And also, if we look at the marginals, then we get out our classical probabilities. So if we integrate over P, then we just get the classical probability distribution for measuring the quadrature Q. And similarly, if we integrate out Q, then we get the probability distribution for measuring P. And so in the handout, I've also drawn the marginals of all of those different states.
How do you go from beta to NQ?
Beta is Q and IP. So, yeah. Yeah, I was going to hand draw some of these vigna functions, but we're kind of running short on time, so I won't do that. But hopefully when I hand draw them in the future, you'll see how my drawings map to the pictures that you've seen. Okay, so I've told you, I've given you, a rough outline of how you would quantize the electromagnetic field. And I've shown you what these Wigner functions look like and hopefully motivated why they're useful. And they're going to come up in the next few lectures and also in the rest of this lecture. But now I kind of want to change the direction a little bit and move on to nonlinear optics. And I want to do that because I want to eventually motivate how we actually make these non-classical states of light. So nonlinear optics is a branch of optics that describes the behavior of light in nonlinear media. And the nonlinearities in these media are typically quite weak. So it's not enough to just have a flashlight that you shine on some sort of nonlinear material. You typically need something that's strong, like a laser, to induce these nonlinearities. And so a typical nonlinear material is a dielectric. So a dielectric is an insulator, which means that the electrons don't freely flow through the material, but it does respond to an applied electric field in some way. So you can displace the electrons to some extent, even though they can't flow through, freely through the material. So maybe I'll write that down. Type of insulator. So electrons don't move freely, but can move a little in response to an applied field. Okay, so let's just consider a simple model of a nonlinear medium. So it's a box, and it's made out of atoms. So the atoms have a positive nucleus, and then they have a cloud of electrons around the outside. And then we can apply a field . So let's say I'm applying it in this direction . So what happens is our nucleus stays in the same place, but the cloud of electrons is displaced due to this applied field. And because it's displaced, you can see that now you can think of this as a polarization, because we have something that's positive on one side and negative on the other side. And this polarization is going to depend on the field. And if the field depends on time, then this polarization is also going to depend on time. And we can make this more precise by defining what's known as a polarization density, which describes how the polarization changes inside the material. And so for sufficiently small fields, we can tailor expand this this polarization density. And so when I say sufficiently small, I mean still large enough to induce a nonlinearity. So we want to have a laser, but not so large that it like burns the material, right? So there's probably another limit that you reach for sufficiently small, but let's go with that it doesn't burn the material. So this polarization density is going to be a function of time because our field will be a function of time. And then I'm going to Taylor expand it. So it'll have a first order term, which is just like your regular linear interaction, like when you have light going through a piece of glass and it bends. Then you have a second order term, which depends on the field squared and also on this coefficient known as the second order nonlinear susceptibility. And then you have a third order term, which depends on the electric field squared and so on. And so typically, like all materials have a third order nonlinearity and a first order nonlinearity, but only special materials with a type of crystal structure have a second order nonlinearity. So if you have something that's just homogeneous and isotropic, then this second order nonlinearity just perfectly cancels out and you don't get it. So things like these materials we're going to deal with have a crystal structure, but things like glass, for example, they don't have this. The strongest nonlinearity in glass would be the third order nonlinearity. Okay, and so this, let's just define this bit as the nonlinear polarization. And so the nonlinear polarization acts as a source in our wave equation for the electric field. So once I erase things, I'll tell you what this means. Okay, so if we didn't have this source, then all of the, the electric field would evolve as a function of time, but none of the frequency components would couple to each other. But here, because you have the nonlinear polarization in there, you have things like the electric field squared and the electric field cubed. And so if you take a particular field with, let's say, you know, even like one frequency, then you'll be able to create fields that have that frequency squared because you're squaring the electric field or that frequency cubed. So for example, if we take a chi2 medium, and I send in a field that has two different frequency components, so I've got a frequency at omega 1, frequency at omega 2, then the thing that comes out is going to have components that are twice omega 1 because I'm going to be squaring this entire thing. So I'll get twice omega 1, twice omega 2. I can get the sum of omega 2 and omega 1 and the difference between them and so on. And not all of these processes happen at the same time. There's something known as phase matching, which is a property of the crystal and the incoming fields. But typically, we get one of these processes happening. And so actually, before the blue diode was invented, blue lasers used this this process. I think it was frequency doubling that I always get these around the wrong way. But you would put in a laser that is easy to create at a particular frequency. Here, let me get. Yeah, so I think you put in a red laser, which was easy to make. And then if you double the frequency of the red laser, then you're going to get something that's like a blue laser. So these are really useful materials that are used in classical optics all the time. So that was just the classical picture of what these dielectrics look like and how we would model them. In quantum optics, we write down a Hamiltonian that describes this effective interaction. So in the last couple of minutes, I'll just write down the Hamiltonian, and then in the next lecture, I'll show you how we evolve the state according to that Hamiltonian to generate these non-classical states of light. Like I said, there are a number of different processes that can happen, but only one of them ever happens. Typically, only one of them ever happens at a time. So the process that we're going to look at is called spontaneous parametric downconversion. And it's actually a process that you can't model using the classical equations, but it's kind of analogous. I think it's analogous to the difference frequency generation. Is that true? Yeah, so tomorrow I'll show you how it's analogous to that one. But it's analogous in the sense that you only have one of these pumps, and then you're creating photons at like a difference frequency that corresponds to a pump that doesn't exist, which doesn't make sense, but I'll talk about it tomorrow. So for spontaneous parametric downconversion, we're going to make some assumptions. We'll say that it's single mode to begin with, which means we're only going to consider one color. And we're going to assume that we have a classical pump. So this incoming thing, we're going to treat classically. And we're only going to treat the output quantum mechanically. And then we also assume that it's a type 1 downconversion source, which means that the output photons are the same polarization. And so you can write down the interaction Hamiltonian for this, which is going to look like I minus IH bar chi on 2, where chi is the nonlinearity strength. And then we get something that looks like this. And so you can see that now if we evolve if we start off with a vacuum state and then evolve it under the interaction Hamiltonian, it's going to create pairs of photons corresponding to that term here. You look confused, Nick, but I'll go through all of this at the beginning of the next lecture, and we can actually do the calculation. This is for a chi2 medium. Yep. Okay, so what have we done? We've had a brief look at how we would quantize the electromagnetic field. I motivated the Wigner functions. And then I gave you a brief cartoon picture of how we can model a dielectric classically. And I started the description of spontaneous parametric downconversion. But we'll go through this section again tomorrow morning. And then I'll show you how we can generate non-classical states of light using that interaction. Are there any questions? Yes, Nick.
With that I in your Hamiltonian term, it's not permission anymore. Why is that?
Yeah, there might be something weird there.
For mine, it's between gay and gay day. It's terribly important.